Hey, AM writers, Jess here with another Great Courses Plus update on what I have been learning. So as I mentioned, I have been listening to a lot and watching a lot of Masterpiece Theater, PBS Masterpiece Theater, but which, by the way, you can get as like an add-on on your Prime account on Amazon. So I've been watching a little of everything, including the new All Creatures Great and Small remake. Oh my gosh, it's so good. So I went to the Great Courses Plus and I did a deep dive into a course called The Great Tours. England, Scotland, and Wales. And you can go see some of the places that are in, for example, All Creatures Great and Small in Yorkshire. You can go to the places that are in the Jane Austen that I was listening to last week and in the books that I've been reading. And you can, because I also watched Sanditon and I was a little bit curious about that area. And I've spent a lot of time in England, but some of the places I've never been able to go, I was able to visit virtually through videos on the Great Courses Plus. So if you are interested in watching or listening to any courses on the Great Courses Plus and you haven't signed up, you can go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/amwriting and get an entire month for free. And you can do this these weird deep dives into, Austen, England, BBC sort of stuff. It's just been so much fun. And enjoy. Have some fun. Learn something.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is #AmWriting, the podcast about writing all the things, be they fiction, nonfiction, short things, long things, in-between things, pitches, proposals. This is the podcast about sitting down and getting that work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the To Be Published Any Moment Now, Addiction Inoculation, and currently writing for various outfits, including New York Times and Washington Post and places like that.
I'm Serena Bowen. I'm the author of 35 romance novels, and my new one is called Bombshells. You can find me wherever your favorite ebooks are sold or at serenabowen.com.
And I am KJ Delantonia, the author of the novel The Chicken Sisters, as well as the nonfiction book How to Be a Happier Parent, currently in the deep and stressful throes of revision on what I expect is going to be novel number two. And not writing for anyone else or thinking about anything else at the moment.
That's probably wise.
Ever.
Coming from someone who's struggling right now to stay above water, that's probably a wise thing at the moment.
Yes. I'm going to play with working on two projects at once in my next, once this is off my plate, but we'll see how that goes. Who knows? All right. Well, we have a great episode planned for today. We have got questions from you all, and we are going to answer them. At least we're going to try to answer them. That might be a better way.
Knock them all down.
Yeah. So we reached out to our Facebook group, which if you are not a part of, you totally should be. It is Am Writing on Facebook, and you can find it by searching for it. It's not hard. I will put the link in the show notes. And people ask questions and we are gonna answer them. And we've just decided sort of randomly to do this in order. So Jess is gonna leap into question number one.
We just got this one recently. It's a fantastic question. Is someone going to steal my work in progress or WIP? I want to find an expert, but I don't want to share my idea. How can I do that? That's a great question. It's also, someone asked me recently why I don't talk about the next book that I'm working on, or when is it safe to start talking about the book that I'm working on, or aren't other people going to jump on it? You can talk about your book idea out in public, I think, once the book has been sold. Some agents will tell you not to talk about it until the book has been actually sold. And then when you're talking to experts, just make sure that you let that expert know that this is the thing you're working on. In academia in particular, it would be really poor form to jump on someone else's idea while they're working on it. And once a book has been announced, for example, it's out there. All the publishers and editors know that someone else is working on the same thing. In fact, we had this come up one time when I was talking to my editor about my first book, and she just sort of keeps an eye on the forecast for what's coming out for the next couple of years. So someone would notice if someone else was working on your thing and then another couple people jumped on. So I'm not too worried about it. You can also, if you want, you can go ahead and make an agreement before you talk with that expert to not talk about it in public. I suppose if you're the kind of person who does this, you could possibly do an NDA. Some people do that. Some people, especially like celebrity books and stuff like that, can do non-disclosure agreements. But I think just letting people know that this is your work in progress and, you know, letting people know that you would prefer that they not talk about it publicly is probably good enough.
That said, ideas do hit the ether, as is exemplified by our episode Room for Two Princesses, Jess's book, and our friend Julie Lithcott-Hames' book, which had very similar themes, were published at almost exactly the same time, and that worked out fine. Mm-hmm. People don't just read one book on a topic.
It's true.
So, you know, get the instinct to protect your work, but also... you know, be aware, first of all, that somebody could just have come up with the same idea. Yep. And secondly, that it's probably okay.
In fact, we know someone who just published a book, and there was a book on the exact same, very narrow focus topic published in this.
It was a battle in Africa
in Jamaica, actually. It was really interesting. And it two books came out like just the same time, and both did really well. In fact, one was nominated for a major award. It went fine.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. So similarly, we have another question. What are the pros and cons of talking about a work in progress? And I wanted to look at this one from a fiction point of view. So when it comes to fiction, I think you're not really thinking about someone stealing your idea, because I'm going to write a romance and a girl's going to meet another girl and they're going to fall in love, you can steal that idea. Feel free. it's all good. So when it comes to fiction, you know, with some caveats, I guess, I think we're a little less concerned about the possibility that somebody's going to snatch your idea up and run with it. So this is more like, I feel like this question is more goes to, should you go for a walk with a writer friend and hash out some details that you're struggling with? And the answer to that, in my opinion, is 100% yes, but it may just have to do with how you process ideas. If it's helpful to you to sit down, even like, I know people that sit down with their partner or their kid or some, you know, non-writers and talk about the plot that they're working on. I would have a hard time doing that because I have a hard time believing in the reality of my plot until I have really, really, really dug into it. But I'm getting better now that I've written more. So I think there's a lot of value to sitting down and talking about where you are, especially if you're stuck.
I would just like to say that I used to worry about working for a year on a novel and then seeing a similar book come out. And it took me years to figure out that that wasn't actually an issue. Because if that book did well, that was only going to help me. And honestly, also this. Like, if you think about who could steal your idea, and maybe that, like, talking to an expert thing is, like, the best example of someone who could steal your idea, but here's the wicked truth. It is really hard to write a book, and you could spray paint your idea all over the city that you live in, and nobody might have the guts and the fortitude to go write that thing. So I don't have that fear anymore, really.
And even if they start... You know, we've also seen that very often they don't finish. So, yeah, that's a big hurdle to jump over.
Okay. Well, somebody asked also, can you make a living writing? And I just love this question so much because, first of all, the three of us here all do that. Like, we all make a nice, comfortable living writing. But the answer is not your first year unless you are so, so super lucky. And also, it depends what you're writing. Like, I'm not going to stand here with the pom-poms and say you can make six figures writing haiku, because I personally don't know anyone who's managed that. And every kind of writing has a different market for it. So if your goal in life is to make your living writing, I'm here to tell you that if you pay attention, you can do that. But if your goal in life is to make a living writing exactly what you want to write in exactly the format you want it, well, then I don't know, you know, probably not. The market is real. If you want to be the kind of writer who earns cash, then you sometimes have to conform to that. Like, can you make a living juggling? Well, you know, you'll have to ask a professional circus performer how easy that is to do. But the answer is a qualified yes, if you're willing to recognize that markets exist and figure out where you fit in.
I actually do know a juggler who made a very nice living, actually, as a juggler. In fact, it was who I was dating when I met my husband. So, yeah, it can be done. It's true. Is it my turn again?
It is your turn again.
This is a good one. How to suck up to influencers.
Okay, I gave you this one special.
Okay, so sucking up. How do you get the attention of sucking up is such a loaded term, but okay. So essentially...
No, and it might also have been phrased as, how do you get the attention of influencers right. without looking like right. you're sucking right. up? But it was asked twice, and I kind of like the first
yeah.
one.
So my, you know, the greatest response that I've always gotten to an appeal to just sort of get to know someone or create a connection with or have a conversation about work with is to be an actual fan of the person's work, right? So like I when I listen to a podcast, I just got a podcast interview recently because a year and a half ago, I reached out to someone who was creating a podcast that I thought was just doing something new and interesting. And I really had no ulterior motives whatsoever, except for to tell this person that I really liked their work. And that created a really great connection, which led to something down the road. You know, honestly, the best connections come out of your sincere appreciation for what they're doing, your sincere wish to, you know, to reach out. And, you know, a lot of people have people ask a lot of things from them. And it's usually, I know that I respond to reader emails and letters when they're specific about something that a question they have or something they liked about something they read. So people who just reach out and say, here's a tit for tat, that's a little less likely to engage me as someone who, yeah. And being diligent about it. Like I, you know, like the Dax Shepard thing, the armchair expert thing, you know, that took me 2 years, but it was also regular reaching out without getting insistent and without getting all huffy that no one was getting back to me. So just be patient and sincere connection based on the appreciation of the work.
And if you want to be a little calculated about it, which is fine, do your initial reaching out before you want anything.
Yes.
So you're going to know that you have a book coming out at least a year before that book comes out, almost certainly. That is the moment to start looking for similar authors and influencers and people and connecting with them in a way that it does not ask anything of them.
Yeah.
So as Jess said, it's genuine. It's real. Obviously, this is your subject. If you've got a book coming out about it, or if you're writing fiction that you probably read in this genre, you're a true fan. Be that.
Yes.
Just be louder about it than you might naturally be or than you might have been before.
Yep.
The next question kind of goes along with this, and it's about best practices for writers on the Goodreads platform. So Goodreads has, I don't know, something like 20 million registered members, and it's owned by Amazon. And it's a bit of a library tracking device where you can add all your own books. And it's a social network, and there's lots of people reviewing books on there. So there's two schools of thought about this. One is that for authors, Goodreads is like a bad neighborhood that you need to stay out of because people will just say anything about your book, and it is totally their right to do so there. You know, it's a reader platform, so, you know, they can give you a 1-star and tell you you're terrible. And it's not really any of your business. And that is basically true, except that Goodreads has a lot of different functionality that does help an author. So you can be on that platform and make it useful to you without ever reading a single review. And one way that you can do that is to review your own book, but not actually as a review. It's just in that spot. But when you, if you have friends on Goodreads and you should just accept all the requests that come to you, and people will also follow you as fans. If you take that review spot in your book to say, yay, this book is coming out soon, And here's why I'm so excited about it. Nobody is going to mistake that as you actually trying to review your own book and slide it in there. They're just going to see it because it's going to hit their newsfeed if they are following you. And that's fine. You know, you're allowed to be excited about your own book as long as you don't pass any judgment on things that other people say about your book. And there's also, it's a little hard to find, but there's a general update thing on Goodreads that is not associated with a book. And you can also put up a general thing on Goodreads that says, hey, I'm having a tuna salad sandwich for lunch today, and I enjoyed this other book by so-and-so Susie author. You know, enthusiasm is never misplaced, you know, as long as you're not there to judge anyone. So it's possible to be a Goodreads author and stay in your own lane, and I encourage you to try it.
Can I ask you a quick question, Serena? Is your advice going to be in general to just keep your fingers out of reviews of your book? You know, on Goodreads, it's in particular bad form to get into a discussion with someone, get into an Goodreads argument with someone who has reviewed your book. But in general, do you think that's your advice?
Yeah, I would never want to. The only time I will ever reply to a reader is if they email me. That is it. Like if they email me, and even then, most of the time, I will not reply because those reviews are not for you. Like they're not feedback. They're for other readers. And I'm not saying you can never learn anything from a review. I'm saying it is not your business to engage with a reviewer, and they will not take it well.
I love that the way you said it that first time, that it is not your business. I like thinking about it that way.
Let's talk about using Goodreads before you have a book out. How can you establish a good sort of a good base there if that's what you want to do?
Well, so that does bring up an important point, which is, you know, social media lasts forever. All writers are readers first, or at least they should be. So it's possible for you to have lots of reviews under your Goodreads for things you were reading like 10 years before you got your book deal. So I would suggest you go back and look and see what things you wrote about people and maybe delete the ones that are unflattering because authors are allowed to have any opinion at all, but once you start taking money for publishing books, it's, I think, bad form to hold yourself out as a reviewer of other people's books in a critical way. There's lots of exceptions to this. Like plenty of authors review books for the New York Times Book Review. I'm not saying that's bad form, but like just, you know, wander by and shoot at one of your competitors with a 2-star review is not maybe a great idea. So you just have to like review your presence there as an author and decide which parts of it are still appropriate.
And if you want to sort of amp yourself up in the year or so before you know you have a book coming out, great. And if you don't, I think that's great too. I would stick to Goodreads. The reviewing side, like the user side of Goodreads, is great for you if you love it and you want to do it. And if you don't love it and you don't want to do it, then roll with that.
Right. And I should have said this is actually quite important. You can leave a quote review on Goodreads without using any stars. So when I say that I've used that review spot to introduce a book of mine, I would never touch the stars. And the same is you can write something about a colleague's book without putting any stars. You know, you can say, oh, my friend had just published this and I got to read an early version and it was so good. I loved it. You know, great. Like nobody's going to look at that and think that you're, I don't know, being deceptive or competitive or any of those things we don't want to be seen to be.
Right.
I want to put a postscript on what Serena said about going back and, you know, maybe getting rid of those, 2-star reviews where you did a drive-by and just took a pot shot at someone. So I wanted to add just this little story about just how small this world can be and how much we really need each other. So a couple of years ago, something I said in an interview got some backlash, and there were a lot of people that I had to block out there on social media because they were just horrible. And, you know, whatever, it was fine. But we blocked those people. And so when I was asked to review a book recently, I was like, oh my gosh, this sounds like such a cool topic. I'm really excited. And then I went to go find the person on social media and I couldn't because I had blocked them because they had been pretty horrible to me. And so I had to write back to that editor and say, I'm sorry, but I'm just not the right person to review this book. But I can tell you right now, I was going to love that book and I could have written a great review for that book, but now I can't. So just let's be nice to each other, authors. I think it's maybe worth your while. I know that this person who was mean to me missed out on probably what was going to be a really enthusiastic review in a really high profile publication. So there you go.
All right. That's an excellent lesson. I love it. And kind of satisfying. Yep. So we like that too. The next question that we have, what do you do? This sort of segues off of the Goodreads question. What do you do when publishers or agents are telling you your platform isn't big enough? I'm gonna take a sort of different tack to this and say, I think that's an excuse. I think that the real answer to that is I don't like this book enough to take it on unless you were super, super famous, which, okay, fine. That kind of went without saying. And the fact that we now get to use this platform line is just, it's honestly, I think it's just another thank you very much, but this is not right for us at this time. I don't think you should panic over your platform. Let me offer as an example our recent guest, Olga Mecking, who I think would tell you herself that she just got her fun book about, I think it was called, it had one of those crazed Dutch words, and then it was The Art of Doing Nothing. I don't remember the Dutch word for doing nothing, but it's super fun. And she got a book contract because she wrote a super fun article that people really liked. She does not have a platform. So if you're sort of naturally developing a platform around what you're doing, that is great. And you should be doing that. You should be connecting with the people in your field. You should be hopefully getting some articles published, getting yourself established, maybe becoming someone that people turn to for quotes and things like that. But I would not spend a lot of time stressing over the actual numbers.
I think that sometimes platform really does matter. You know, one of the reasons that Jess does so well is because she was so well positioned to write The Gift of Failure as someone who had worked with kids in an education setting. If Jess had the same idea for that book, but was just a mom standing around on the playground wishing people let kids fail, she would not have had the same book contract. So sometimes it does matter. But I will tell you that my very first published book was a niche cookbook, and I had no platform, and I was not a chef and had never been to cooking school. But it was so niche that Random House was like, yup, come right this way. That's a perfectly good idea. And it was right before the whole blog to book phenomenon happened. It's possible that if I had tried to sell that book like 3 years later when they were buying up bloggers who had 20,000 followers or whatever they were looking at the time, WordPress or whatever, it's possible that I would not have sold that book, which is still in print more than 10 years later. Oh, my kid is 15. Wow. So a long time. So sometimes platform matters and sometimes it really doesn't, like KJ said. And I have this feeling that nonfiction acquiring editors value platform more than they should, because it's like it's an insurance policy of their own taste. Like if the book doesn't do well, they're like, well, they're the editor of that section in this newspaper. You know, at least I can say that I chose well. And I think in fiction, they actually underpriced platform sometimes. Like in fiction, acquiring a book is more about love and like gut instinct than platform. So, you know, if you don't have the right platform for your book, but it's a smashing idea, it's still going to turn out great.
So there's two definitions of platform here, just to make it clear. One is you're now, you know, those numbers on your social media platforms. And the other is your real, genuine experience. And that is a totally different thing. And if you don't have enough of that to carry through with the idea, then that may be an issue.
Yeah, I think the one thing I wanted to point out was if editors or agents are pointing at your social media platform and saying you don't have enough of that, then your platform like why I'm the one to write this book right now needs to be as strong as possible. Highlighting why my social media following when I got Gift of Failure was not much of anything, but my platform, my career, my experience, my life experience was just at that exact place where no one else was writing from at the time. And I think strengthening that as much as possible when you don't have the social media platform is useful.
Right. And platforms so slippery. Like you had just had that article go totally not so viral.
Yeah.
And it was still doing laps around the planet. So that's a platform of one kind.
That's true.
But that's true. But you had no Instagram account, you know. So
no, I did not have any.
The definition is different depending on, you know, what we're talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good point.
All right, Jess, give us another question.
Okay, so another question that I'm loving here is, protocol around asking for blurbs. Okay, protocol around asking for blurbs is this. So first you start by just brainstorming all of the people who would be like, who are your dream blurbers? And great, definitely, this is like applying to college. Have a reach in there. Definitely have a reach in there. Have a couple of people who are experts in your field, especially if you're writing nonfiction and you are not acknowledged as an expert in that field. It can be really helpful for you to have someone who is a respected person in that field. It can also be, obviously, bestsellers are great. Name recognition is great. But for a lot of people that write nonfiction, getting someone who is a big deal in a particular field that you're trying to become an expert in is key. Then how do you do it? So there are a couple rules, and some people follow these rules and some people don't. So with Gift of Failure, we did not ask anyone for blurbs who was actually in the book because the person writing the blurb, you know, might have some, you know, conflict of interest about blurbing something that they're actually in. Some editors and agents have no problem with this whatsoever. We also didn't, you know, you may not... This is about appearances. You may not want to ask other authors who are with your same editor, but no one really knows that. So then in the approach. So because I get asked to blurb, one thing I do is I ask people at the proposal stage if they would be willing to commit their name to my proposal as someone who is willing to at least receive a copy and read with an eye to blurbing, not promise to blurb, but that you promise to read my book, and that's it. And I even got one funny reply from one major influencer who was like, okay, but you're asking for so little. Sure, put me down. Because, you know, at that point, all you're doing is asking, are you willing to get an early copy and like think about the possibility of reading it? And who's going to say no to that, frankly? So then you've got their names on your proposal as possible blurbers. And then when it actually comes time, what I do is I say, hi, remember years ago when you offered to put your name on my proposal? It's time for you to get this thing. Obviously, I'm not asking you about whether or not you will blurb right now, I'm asking you to read my book with an eye to blurbing. And if you plan to blurb, here is the date by which we would need that blurb in order for it to go out on the galleys. I'm so grateful. Either way, whether you're willing to blurb or not blurb, I'm so grateful for your time. And I think that's the nicest, unless someone else has some feedback on that, I think that's the nicest possible way to go, because when I get asked to blurb, and I always have to reply, I can't promise to blurb. I can promise to read, and that's all I can give you for now. And by the way, you giving me this book on March 31st and saying you need the blurb back by April, or, you know, by April 15th is gonna not work for you. Give your readers enough time to actually read, and if that means that your possible blurbers get an e-copy instead of a paper copy or a bound manuscript instead of a proper galley, then that's fine. But give them enough time and give them that door to say no, because it's stressful for us when we don't feel like we have the ability to say no. So give them that option.
I want to add that after Jess sends that email saying, remember how I asked you to blurb and now can I send you the book and maybe you'll... Then she curls up in a little ball on the floor and eats.
That's true.
Like, I don't want it to sound like Jess is like, and then I dance in the fields with fairies because I don't really care if anyone blurbs her. But no. We all care deeply. And it is really hard and really painful in many instances to send these emails.
Yeah. And honestly, for me, it's those people that I respect most as authors in the entire world, I'm asking them to blurb. And you're probably those authors, besides my agent and my editor, are the first people to read the book. And that is one of the scariest things on the whole planet.
I would like to add a glamour don't. So a couple years ago, I got an email from a big five editor that I have never worked with and did not know, but she ran the division, so I guess she just assumed that I knew who she was. And she's not there anymore, but she sent me this email, and I read it over breakfast, and it said, "Dear Serena, so-and-so thought you might be willing to blurb her new book in this genre that you also write in." The parallel was clear. "So here's what I would like you to say in the blurb. And I guess if you wanted to see the book, we could send it over." I read it like five times. And I'm like, I don't even know you. And she was telling me the blurb she wanted. It was bonkers. So there are still people willing to do that. And then I also had someone I know just glancingly this past year ask me to blurb her book and sent me the PDF. And she's like, "But if you don't have time, a general quote would do." And I felt so nauseated being sort of like pushed to give her a blurb without reading the book. Like,
yeah,
I didn't say anything, but I was at war with myself for like an entire day. Like, am I supposed to write her back and say, like, "You made me so uncomfortable asking me, you know, in so many words to blurb your book without actually reading it." And in the end,
I've been told that too.
I have actually done that, and willingly and voluntarily, because someone had written a book about a parenting topic that is so far in my distant past that I did not want to read the book. But I was this was a person who'd actually written an entire column for me at one point. Mm-hmm. It was not Jess. and I was more than happy to say, you know, if you want advice on this particular topic, that she's the go-to. Mm-hmm. But that was, you know, she didn't ask me to do it that
way.
Well,
if it's your choice, that's different.
Yeah, totally different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally different. I want to say on the fiction front, because this is such a fun topic, that you're asking a lot. You're asking for somebody to read your book and maybe comment on it, especially if you're reaching out to authors that you really admire and you don't know. On the one hand, that is very true. But on the other hand, presumably you have written your very best book. These are authors that write in your genre and probably read in your genre. So really, you know, you're offering, here's a book you might want to read anyway. If you do and you read it in time and you'd like to say something kind about it, that, you know, I would love that. So there is an ask in there, but I feel like the ask is not as great as we feel it is if you're targeting your blurbs right. And most people have a pretty ready way to say no. I actually just said she would never say no to, "Can I basically send you a book in this area?" Or that most people wouldn't. I actually will. Because sometimes it's like, "No, I'm sorry, but I don't like fiction in which the dog dies. There are no circumstances under which I'm not going to read it." So, you know, the fact that your book is titled "And Then the Dog Died," that just tells me it's not for me. Like, I'm done. Sorry. I'm out.
There's a helpless woman in peril and then her dog dies. That is basically the genre right there of no KJ.
Genre of things I don't read. We could add to it, but yeah. And you don't know that about the author, too. When somebody doesn't want to read your book, you know, you don't know. It could be that they just have a real, real thing about alarm clocks and there's one in your book and they just don't want anything to do with that.
Well, and also I've also have to deal with the fact that some people who have agreed to read I have had to accept the fact that if I poke once and I still don't hear back, that's the person saying, please don't poke me again. I don't want to have to tell you how much I didn't like your book. And that's cool. That's okay. That has to be okay.
It's not. Right? It's awful. It's horrible. And yet, yes, it has to be okay.
We're allowed to not like books sometimes. That's how this whole thing works. It's okay.
Well, speaking of that, let's take a minute, shift gears, and talk about some books that we have really liked. And let me just say, if you asked a question and we didn't get to it, don't worry. We're going to do this again very soon. Spring is coming, slowly, here in New England, and we're excited about the whole idea of change and new beginnings and birds and grass and stuff like that. What does that have to do with hashtag amwriting? Well, maybe it's time for a new beginning for you as a book coach. Just imagine enrolling in the classes, meeting a cohort, learning all the ways coaches are editorial and emotional support for writers, and then starting to line up your first clients. Students working with Author Accelerator's book coaching program say they often begin to book authors before they're even done with the course, and they end up being booked ahead months in advance. Sound like fun? I absolutely agree. Go to bookcoaches.com to learn more.
All right, so I read a book this week that I saw at the bookstore. I hate being those people at the independent bookstore who takes pictures of books to remind myself to read them, because then it looks like I'm, I don't know, taking a picture of it so I can look it up on the Zon or something like that to order it. But that's not what I'm doing, independent booksellers, I promise. I tend to listen to a lot of my books, and so that's what I have done with this one. I saw the cover of the book Yellowbird by Sierra Crane Murdoch, and it hits all the buttons for me. It is a true crime. It is about someone's lived experience that is not mine on a Native American reservation. And it's also it digs into who should be able to tell stories and who shouldn't a little bit, which is really interesting, because the author of the book goes to investigate a missing guy on a guy who's been missing from an oil field. And there's another woman who's actually Native American and lives on the reservation who is also interested in this disappearance. So you have three people sort of involved in this whodunit. Where did this guy go? One white woman, one woman who's indigenous and lives on the reservation. And it's the book. It just flows beautifully. The reporting is gorgeous. It has a real sense of place to it. I'm just really loving it. It's called Yellowbird by Sierra Crane Murdoch.
I'm so excited to hear that, because I am in a larger writer group with her, and the paperback of that, I believe, just came out. It's so great to have this, you know, I love it when the books coincide without you actually doing anything about it.
Right.
Well, I'm going to tell y'all about a book that I actually did blurb back when I was reading instead of revising constantly, which is what I am doing now. So nobody asked me to blurb right now. It is called The Cup of Silver. No, it's just called Cup of Silver Linings. There's no V, by Karen Hawkins. It is her second book in what's called the Dove Pond series. It is an adorable, wonderful, charming series about a little Stars Hollow-esque town with lots and lots and lots of magical realism. People show up in town thinking that they're gonna leave, and they get sucked in and they don't, and they have to resolve their problems with the people that they love but can't quite connect with. Really, although they're books with a lot of magical realism, they're really at their heart. This is the second in the series, and the other one was the same way. They're really about forgiveness, forgiving yourself and forgiving other people. And if you need a lift, I just go ahead. Just go grab it and dive in, because they're definitely, they belong in that thing you get in your Facebook. Sometimes it's like, need some good news? Whatever. They're so much fun. All right. And Serena has been writing.
She's been writing like a crazy person.
We allow that.
Yep.
No reading. That's where I am right now. We're going to be that way on the next episode for me. I'm like, I don't read anything. I'm going to read right now.
Well, I just started something that I'm excited to talk about next time we talk that is so good. So we'll have to wait till then.
Okay.
But until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. #AmWritingPodcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.